Well, hi, everybody. My name is Kay. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Kay.
I think I'm having a stroke. My eye is twitching and my jaw hurts. So I'm going to be real nervous at first, but that'll pass. I'm going to try to talk up. I'm a low talker, so if you're having a problem, try to get my attention. The big book suggests that we share what it was like, what happened, and what it's like, and I'm going to try to do that. And before I start, my home group is the Ocean View Speakers Meeting in Norfolk, Virginia. We meet on Monday nights. We've been meeting there for over 60 years. It's an awesome home group, and I'm hoping to see some of you there real soon. My sobriety date is February 22nd, 1986, and I think as of today, I'm a member in good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just want to thank Billy for inviting me up here. It's been a beautiful day, just a beautiful ride up. The weather is perfect. Thank you, God. It's just been lovely. You live in a beautiful place, and I'm happy to be here. First, I want to qualify. I hope I don't overqualify. I tend to do that sometimes, but I'm going to try to keep it. Well, I'm not going to try anything. God help me. My alcoholism. I think the first things I ever remember thinking about as a child, I've looked back on my childhood, as we all do, and the first things I remember thinking about are feelings. I remember thinking about how I felt, and I remember feelings of fear, intense fear, and I'm only, you know, I got back to like 5 years old, and that's when I first could remember anything, and it was feelings of fear and shame, and I don't know where the hell that came from. I come from a beautiful, loving family. I wasn't abused. I wasn't harmed. I don't know where those feelings came from, but I remember them vividly. And it hasn't changed much. All through my life, I'm intensely interested in my feelings. I dwell on them a lot, and I think about what I'm feeling. And like I said, it's my feelings. I've never been intensely interested in anybody else's unless it pertained to mine. And I didn't know that, you know. I'm just starting to find that out, you know, in sobriety. But that, looking back, that's the way it always was. I've been always intensely interested in what's going on with me. And the only interest I can work up for anybody else is if it pertains to me. Looking back, that's a pretty sad way to live, but that's the way I lived. And I can get like that today pretty easily. So I remember feeling fear and feeling uncomfortable and all those things that we talk about up here. And because I'm intensely interested in myself, I thought I was the only one feeling these things. Because I looked around and I saw my family looked like they were okay. My friends looked like they were okay when I went to school. Everybody looked okay but me. And I'm like, what is wrong with me? And why can't I be like them? And why can't I feel comfortable? So from the very beginning, I had this feeling of discontent and restlessness. I thought, if I go over here and play with those kids, I'll feel better. Or if I do this, they'll like me and I'll feel okay. So I was restless and discontented and very uncomfortable. And that could lead to irritation. So that's how I was without ever having a drink. And really, that's the way I went through my life in high school. I was a typical teenager, kind of antisocial and sullen, but it was aggravated by I stayed inward all the time. So if anybody tried to be friendly to me, I really didn't respond. And it made me seem like I was stuck up, but really I was full of fear. But I had the reputation of being, you know, stuck up and a loner. And one person had the nerve, or the, I don't know what, but she came up to me and she introduced herself. And she said, we're going to be great friends. And this was in the in high school. And we're friends today. And I don't know where that came from, but I'm extremely grateful for her. She was, she's been my friend through everything. But that was about it. I didn't have a lot of friends. And that was just the way it was. And I kind of liked it that way, because then I didn't have to extend myself. I didn't have to be more uncomfortable than I already was. I come from a family of four. My mother was a single mom, and she raised four kids. I have two older sisters. One is deceased, and there was 12 years difference between my two older sisters and my brother and I. And so I always felt kind of special. It was like two separate little families. And my mother wasn't supposed to be able to have any more children, and she had me, and that made me feel special. And that's another thing that's going on in this head of mine. I think I'm special. I really feel special a lot of the time, and that's going on in my head, too. And so I've got this, I feel like a piece of crap. Nobody likes me. There's something wrong with me. But there I'm, this special thing going on. So I've got these two things going on in my body all the time and in my head. And I don't know what to do with them. And I don't have anybody to talk to about them, because why would I, you know, what would I say? And who would I say it to? That was the kind of attitude I had. And this is how I went along in high school. And I ended up living, my mother worked two jobs, and she couldn't be home enough for my brother and I, so she sent us out to live with my older sister and her her boyfriend. And so I lived out in Virginia Beach to go to high school, and I was living with my sister and her boyfriend. And they went out every Saturday night to the Moose Lodge to drink and dance and have a good time and relax. And they had parties at home during the week too, but Saturday night was the big deal. And I would beg them to take me with them. I didn't know what they were doing out there, but they'd get all dressed up, they smelled good, and they were laughing, and I wanted to go with them. And so finally, when I was 16, my sister and her boyfriend said, okay, we're going to take you out with us. And I got dressed up in one of her fancy dresses, and her boyfriend said, I'm going to fix you a drink. And he said at the time, this is going to be so that when you start dating, I hadn't started dating at that point, when you start dating, boys can't sneak liquor in your drink and get you drunk and take advantage of you. Okay. I don't even have a boyfriend, but okay. So he fixed me a rum and Coke, and he fixed it in a highball glass with a lot of ice and a lot of Coke and a little rum. And I took that, I could smell it before I drank it, and it didn't smell so good, but I had seen them drinking, you know, and it looked good. It looked fun. They were happy when they were doing this. So I took it and I drank it down because it didn't smell good. And I drank the whole thing down and it didn't taste good, but it was going down, and when it hit bottom, I felt something. And all those feelings I had been hanging out with my whole life, when it hit bottom, a few minutes later, a sense came over me of great, great relief. And it was, I always describe it as I had been holding my breath for all my life, and when I took that drink, I let it go. And boy, did it feel good. It's hard holding your breath that long. But that's the way I was all the time, like this. And I took that drink and everything. My whole body relaxed. My brain relaxed. I quit thinking about this stuff. I quit worrying about it. I was okay. And we went to the Moose Lodge, and they were all up dancing, all these old people. I always say that. They were in their 30s, and they were all old people to me. And they were playing country and Western music. I don't like that, but, you know. So there's a band playing, and they're up on the floor dancing. There's that twirly, sparkly ball going around. It's dark. And everybody was sitting at these round tables that had maybe 10 chairs. They're big round tables. And while everybody was up dancing and having a good time, I was drinking their drinks. And I didn't think a thing about it, you know. I didn't think about germs, which preoccupied me as a teenager. I didn't want anybody else's cooties. But I didn't consider for a minute I'm drinking behind strangers. I just knew that I wanted some more of that magic stuff. And so I'm drinking everybody's drink, and I'm watching them, and I'm getting happier and happier. And the next thing you know, I'm on the dance floor, and I have a picture. I have a picture from that night, and it's a great thing to have, a picture of your first drunk. And I was 16 years old. I was, you know, young and pretty and innocent, and I had on my sister's beautiful dress. And I had long hair, and I had pulled it up on my head because it got warm. And I had kicked off my shoes, and I'm out there dancing. And I just looked so happy. And there was another picture. I'm sitting with my sister's boyfriend, and I had these black cat-eye glasses, and they were like this. And I can't do it with these. But they were all crooked, and I looked goofy and happy. They're great pictures. It was a great night. It was one of the best nights of my life, if not the best at that point. And I continued to drink people's drinks and have a good time. And at some point in the evening, I went away. And what happened was I was dancing and doing something, and then I was in the car. And that, I don't know what that was, but it was okay. It didn't scare me. It interested me. I said, I wonder how that happened. How did I get from there to here and not know about it? I didn't know what a blackout was. I didn't know. I thought it was interesting. And I got sick the next morning. I didn't feel so good then. It wasn't very magical. And I ended up throwing up, and I had a headache. But I did not connect all of what I was doing the next morning or what I was feeling with the night before. All I could think about, and I dwelled on it, was how wonderful that night was, how wonderful that felt. And from that point on, every chance I got, I tried to drink. I wanted to drink. It was a wonderful thing. And so every chance I got, I drank. I was only 16. I didn't get too many chances, but I took what was offered me. I finally got a boyfriend. He was old enough to buy alcohol. I got him to buy a bottle, a pint of rum. And we went to the drive-in, and I drank most of the rum. And the next weekend, we're going to the drive-in, and I said, don't forget the rum. And he's like, no, I don't want to get any rum. And I'm like, no, you got to get some rum. Remember how great it was? And he's like, no, I don't like the way you act when you drink that stuff. And I couldn't understand that. I thought he was crazy, because I thought alcohol did for him what it did for me. But it didn't. He could take it or leave it. He didn't care. It wasn't anything special, you know. But it did something for me. And right away, as much as I cared for that boy, as important as the boyfriend was to a 17-year-old girl, and as nice a guy as he was, as well as he treated me, I knew right then there wasn't much future for us, because he just didn't like the drinking thing. And so we stayed together, and I could bully him or trick him into buying me liquor, but it was not easy. But he would occasionally, you know. And so we stayed together until I graduated, and then I was going to go to college in Ohio where my sister lived. I got to watch the time. And that summer was my summer to be free and have fun, you know. It was the summer of 1966, and that was a great summer to be young and living life. And so I started going to bars with my sister. She had, her boyfriend went to jail, and so she was footloose and fancy free. And so she's hanging out in bars, shooting pool. She shot pool for a living. She was really good. And so she's hanging out with all these glamorous people. And she let me come along with her. And I was still too young to drink. So she would order a beer and a Coke for me. And then I would drink half the Coke, and she'd pour beer in it. Disgusting. But I drank a lot of that stuff. and so I would drink, and I started smoking, and I started learning how to shoot pool. And I met this guy. And he was awesome, you know. He liked to drink with me, and he drank like I did. So I think alcohol might have done for him what it did for me. And I fell in love that summer. I fell in love with him. I fell in love with bars. I fell in love with shooting pool and smoking and hanging out and drinking. And I had to go to school in Ohio. And so because I was scared of my older sister, she was like a surrogate mother, and she was real mean. I won't say that. She was very adamant about things. And I was afraid of disappointing her or telling her I couldn't come up there. So I went up to Ohio and went to school, and I lasted 3 months. And those 3 months were horrible. I don't think I was doing controlled drinking at that time, but I wasn't drinking. And it was really horrible up there. I could not enjoy the school experience. All I could think about was getting back here. And I told myself I was thinking about getting back here to that guy. But in reality, I wanted to be able to drink. I wanted to be able to do what we had been doing, to have that fun and to have that feeling again. I didn't have that feeling a single day when I was up in Ohio. And I was miserable, and I made everybody miserable around me. So finally, I told my sister I was going back, that I needed to experience life, blah, blah, blah. She was mad, and she said, fine, go home, but you're going to pay me back every penny I've spent. And I said, well, of course I will. I'll go home and get a job. I'll send you your money. And I intended to do that, too. And I came home and got a job at a tent factory that lasted 1 week. It was nasty and dirty and hard. But I did get one paycheck. And out of that paycheck, I sent her $6 with a letter saying, this is the first installment. It was also the last installment. I didn't know that at the time, but it was. So I quit that job, and I'm drinking, and I've met a group of people that like to drink and do drugs. And drugs are not a part of my story, really. I smoked pot, but only if I was drinking. I tried it once without drinking. It was awful. And I said, I'm never doing that again, and I didn't. I'm not a drug addict. I had no problem not smoking pot again, unless I was drinking, because that was the only way it was good for me. Alcohol was the thing I loved. And although I did other things, they were not the thing I loved, you know. So I was doing anything and everything that anybody brought up the pipe, but mostly I was drinking. And this was to go on for a long time. The fun part was getting ready to come to an end. In 1969, I got pregnant, and I got pregnant because I wanted someone to love me and someone to love unconditionally. That's what I was always looking for, somebody to love me and to love unconditionally. Of course, I had conditions galore on people. So I got pregnant, and I didn't need no stinking husband, I said. It was the 60s. But I didn't have a job, and I didn't know how to be a mother. And thank God for my family. My mother was my daughter's mother. She took care of her. My sister helped. My whole family pitched in and helped. And thank God, because I did not know what to do with a baby. And my drinking got worse, and it was becoming harder and harder to be where I said I was going to be. I had to pick my daughter up from the babysitters. I was supposed to pick my daughter up from the babysitters one day, and I stopped for a couple of beers. I didn't pick her up for the next 3 days because I was out and drinking. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to leave my daughter at the babysitters. I didn't want to neglect her. But once I started drinking, that's what happened. And that is the story of my drinking. I always wanted to do great things. I always wanted to be a good person. I always wanted to make a difference in the world. But once I started drinking, the big ideas were all there. But for some reason, the drinking became the thing. And once I started, the ideas were all I had. I couldn't put anything into action. I couldn't, you know, focus. I couldn't be where I was supposed to be. I couldn't do the work that was necessary. And that was what my drinking was like up until the end. It did get considerably worse physically. I was always in relationships with people who drank like me. They were frequently violent. They were always very intense and very alcohol-fueled. So I was always running away from somebody. I would get beat up and I would run home all, you know, bruised and looking like hell. And I'd run home to my mother and she'd cry. And she'd say, you're going to die. You know, they're going to kill you out there. You've got to come home and leave these people alone. Because she didn't know I was an alcoholic. She thought I was hanging out with the wrong people. Thank God she was there to take me in. And so things got progressively worse. I ended up in 1981 working in a bar on First View in Ocean View. It was called Rosie's. It was from World War II. It was just a dive, but it was a great dive. My sister, my older sister who I used to drink with, had managed it. And so she got me a job as a waitress. Oh, God, I was the world's worst barmaid waitress. I had a bad attitude. I usually was sick. I didn't want to talk to people. I never smiled. I didn't get any tips. I don't know why that happened. But my sister was the manager, so I had a job. And I'm working in this bar in 1981. No car. I'd never had a car. And I'm 35 years old. I've never had a vehicle. I've never worked for more than minimum wage. And I'm ending up here in this bar, and I am so miserable. Not even alcohol is helping me anymore. I mean, I'm drinking, and I know I shouldn't be drinking. I haven't quite made the connection that alcohol is my problem. I still had this sense that maybe I was crazy and that I had really bad luck and that I was doomed to just live this awful life. And alcohol was the only thing that lifted that for a minute. And so I would try not to drink, and I just would get feeling better, and I would have to drink. There was just no other recourse. I didn't know what else to do. My sister that I had jilted and left and run out on up in Ohio was also an alcoholic. And I didn't know this. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. But my daughter, when she was 5 years old, my sister came down with her husband and said, you can't take care of this baby. Mom's too old. She's working. She can't take care of the baby. So my husband and I are going to adopt her. And I agreed to that. And I agreed to it because I truly believed they would give her a better life, that they had a house and that they were normal, and they could give her things I couldn't give her. And I also agreed because I was just so guilty and I wouldn't have to be guilty anymore. I wouldn't have to be upset because I forgot her. I wouldn't have to feel all these feelings that maybe something wasn't quite right. And so my sister adopted my daughter. And I had no idea she was an alcoholic. We made these decisions over a case of beer. She was not a drinker like I was. I fell down. My tongue got thick. I couldn't talk. I was just like I was a falling down drunk. I had blackouts always. She wasn't like that. She was a maintenance drinker. She could drink and drink and drink and never look different. And you wouldn't know it until the end of the evening when she stumbled a little bit. But she'd get up the next day and go to work. She'd get up the next day and clean the house. There was none of that for me. But she was an alcoholic. She just could maintain. So I didn't know this, and several years later, she got sober. In 1979, she got sober. And she went in a treatment center, and she wasn't at all happy about it. It took her a year to finally start being sober, damn it, and to start getting into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and to find some joy and happiness and freedom. But when she did, she was a different person. And the big book talks about the person that brings the message that has weight and depth. And when she came home one summer looking bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and looking happy and feeling good and making other people feel good around her, she sat down and talked to me about her alcoholism. And she gave me my first copy of the big book. And she knew I loved to read, so she said, "Here's a book that you might enjoy reading." She didn't say, "You better read this book because you need it bad." She said, "Here's a book. I know you like to read, and you might get something out of this." And then she proceeded to tell me what was going on with her, how she drank, the things she did. And I listened. And I listened intently because she was talking about herself and not me. And while I was listening to her, I heard several things I related to strongly. But I couldn't quite get myself to say, maybe I've got this thing. But I was interested. She had my interest. While she was there that summer, she asked me to go to a meeting with her. It was a speaker's meeting, and I went. It was my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got there before half an hour was up. So it was a speaker's meeting, much like this one, except they had tables in the back and people sitting around them. And we sat at the back because I didn't want to walk up to the front. And there was a young man speaking, telling his story up at the podium. And I'm sitting back there. I weighed 210 pounds. I was fat and miserable. I hadn't washed my hair in days. It was long and stringy. I just felt so hopeless and so tired. And I'm sitting back there in a damn meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm looking around, and these people are all like you, you know? Their skin is healthy and pink. They're not sweating profusely. They're not falling down. They don't smell bad. They're laughing and smiling. And I'm like, oh, my God. You know, this is just, I didn't know what to do with that. And so we're sitting in the back, and I'm listening to this kid talk. He was 25, had 10 years sobriety. I was 35. And I'm just looking at him saying, that doesn't look like any drunk I know. You know, I don't see boys like that in the bar. But I got to hear some of what he was saying, and I could relate to the drinking part of his story. When he talked about his feelings, when he talked about the shame he felt, the things that happened that he didn't want to happen, I could relate to all of that, and I was able to hear that. And at the end of the meeting, a lady got up and gave out chips, which we do in Norfolk, most meetings. And she gave out a white chip. She said, "Anybody want to try this way of life?" And I raised my hand in the back and waited for her to bring it to me. And she looked at me and she smiled very sweetly and she said, "If you want it, come and get it." And those were the most important words to this day I have ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if this was for people who needed it, the rooms would be so full. But it's if you want it. And I wasn't sure I wanted it. But everybody was looking at me, and I don't want to disappoint. And so I walked up there, and I got my first white chip, and I didn't have an idea in hell about what I was doing. I regretted it immediately. I'm like, oh, boy, now what have I got myself into? But I picked it up, And I told my sister, she was going back to Ohio in a few days, and I said, you're going to have to stay here and be my sponsor. Because she was telling me, get a sponsor, get phone numbers, go to meetings. And the only thing I got from sponsor was it was someone you talk to. And I said, well, I'm not talking to these strangers. You're going to have to stay here and be my sponsor. And she said, no, I can't do that. She said, but there's somebody for you. She said, you just got to go out there and ask somebody. And I'm like, no, it's never going to happen. And so she gave me a meeting list, and she said, go to meetings. Listen, get some numbers. You know, let somebody help you. And that was really hard. Once she left, I didn't, you know, you were all strangers to me. You know, today I don't care where I go, you're not strangers. And not just in the rooms. I don't feel like people are strangers anywhere as much as I used to. I'm part of this deal. I'm a part of the human race. And so I don't feel afraid of meeting new people. But boy, did I then. So I went to some meetings. There was a meeting in a treatment center near my house. And so they met every night of the week. And I said, okay, I'll go there. And so for a long time, I went to Serenity Lodge. And the second meeting I went to was a step meeting. They were on step one. And I'm listening to them talk about powerlessness. And I'm like, well, this is easy. I mean, I know all about powerlessness. I mean, I've been a victim all my life. People have been taking advantage of me and using power over me all the time. I know what it feels like, people. I didn't have a clue about what powerlessness was. For many years, I didn't have a clue about that in the rooms. But I thought it was pretty simple. I can read the stuff. I can work the steps because I'm smart. Look, I already got step one. And so I don't need the sponsor thing, and I don't really want to talk to anybody, but I'll go to the meetings. And so that's what I did. I went to meetings. And I did that for 5 years, in and out of the rooms, going to meetings, hanging out, not wanting to talk to anybody, not ever, ever getting honest, not ever asking for help, just hanging out, waiting for the miracle to happen to me by osmosis. And it didn't, and I kept getting drunk and getting drunk. And finally, I picked up a white chip, and I don't know what was different, but I had become friends with this one guy. He was an older gentleman, and he had throat cancer from drinking and smoking, and he had a trach, so you couldn't hardly understand him. Now, I don't talk to people I can understand, because I don't like talking to people, and I did not know why I was drawn to Bill, but I was. He was so nice. He had this open face and smile, and he always looked happy to see me. So I got so I would talk to him. And one day he was laughing at me. We were having a conversation at the Easy Does It Club. And he's laughing. And I'm like, what are you laughing at, Bill? And he said, I'm laughing at you. Well, why? He said, I was holding my hand to my throat the way he does when I was talking to him. I was so intent on talking that I was doing this. And he was laughing at me. But he talked about his sister all the time. You got to meet my sister. She'd be a great sponsor for you. You got to meet Dorothy. She's so sober. And he was just talking her up like crazy. And I love Bill, so I said, okay, fine. They keep talking about this sponsor thing. So he talked me into going to her home group meeting. And it was the Ocean View Speakers meeting, the meeting I belong to today. And so his sister was speaking that night, Dorothy was. And when she talked, I related to an awful lot of what she was saying. She was talking about things I had experienced, especially the drinking part. And she was beautiful. She had her hair in a big old beehive, and she had jewelry on and beautiful clothes, and she had this big smile like Bill did, and everybody knew her after the meeting. They were all coming up, oh, Dorothy, this. So I said, that's a sponsor for me. So I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said, well, sure, honey. And she gave me her phone number. Well, I didn't call her or anything. I did join her home group, and so I saw her every Monday night, so I figured I didn't have to call her. And so I would come late and leave early and didn't get real involved in my home group. And she was sort of sitting back waiting, I think, for me. But just from that little effort of joining a home group and asking someone to sponsor me and going regularly to that home group, I got a year and a half sober. That was the most time, a year and a half dry. And that was the most time I had been able to put together. And I was looking better. I lost weight. I got a good job. Well, it was the best job I'd ever had. It was in a beauty supply house. So I went from Rosie's to a beauty supply house. And I smelled good, and they had nice products. And I was a good employee. I showed up. I was there every day. I did my job the way I was supposed to. my first evaluation, the manager called me in his office and he evaluated my work. And it was wonderful. You're a good worker. You show up. You're polite. You're courteous. And I burst out crying. And he said, "What is wrong?" I said, "I've never heard that stuff from an employer before." And he was he said, "Well, you're a good employee." And boy, that felt good. So I'm riding high, you know. I've lost weight. I'm cute again. I got a good job. I got a good work evaluation. I'm making some money. I'm in a relationship with a drinker who drinks like I used to, but it's okay. I'm gonna help get this person sober. I'm gonna show them how it's done. I got really pissed one night at my alcoholic not coming home and not treating me right, and I went out and bought a 6-pack of beer, and I drank every bit of it. And I'm sitting in my house steaming, thinking about how badly I've been treated, thinking about how bad. First it started out how bad this person was treating me, but then it went to how bad everybody's treating me. And I'm deep in this self-pity and arrogance and anger, and I'm thinking those AA people aren't my friends either, and blah, blah, blah. And something happened in the middle of that drunk, in the middle of my rant in my head, and something happened, and all of a sudden I thought, you're drinking because you're an alcoholic and you can't not drink. And you haven't done anything that those people were talking about. And I didn't, you know, I didn't stop drinking because I can't do that once I start. But something had happened in my brain. And I continued drinking. I passed out. I got up the next morning sick, sick, sick. I dragged my butt into work because it meant a lot to me to be on time. And they sent me home because I was so sick. And they said, just go home, come back tomorrow when you feel better. So I went home and I was too sick that night to go to a meeting, but I got on my knees. And I said the most sincere prayer I was capable of. I said, God, I will do anything, anything, not to drink again and not to feel like this. And I was very sincere. I meant it. All my reservations about stuff I wasn't going to do, things that I didn't have to do, things that were impossible for me to do, they were all gone. I was going to do anything. And the next day I called my sponsor. I said, I'm going to call you every day. I'll do anything you say. I don't want to drink again. I told her I drank. And she said, well, that's great, Kay. That's great. You come to your home group meeting and we'll start working on these steps and we'll get you know, where you're supposed to be. And I'm like, okay. And so I went to a meeting that night. It was a Saturday night and I went to the Bayview meeting. And I went up to a young man sitting in a chair and I introduced myself. That was one thing I didn't do. I didn't go up to strangers and introduce myself. And I went up to him and I said, my name's Kay. I'm an alcoholic. I drank. I don't want to do that anymore. Can you help me? And he had 6 months more than I did. And he was so excited. Oh, boy, yes, I'm going to help you. We're going to be great friends. And we were. And he dragged me around to meetings and he taught me how to have fun in sobriety. I had not gotten the knack of that by myself. And it wasn't easy at first. He literally had to drag me. But we went to picnics and we went to parties and we went to all kinds of AA events. And gradually, gradually, I was able to relax and have a good time. It was a wonderful feeling. I started working the steps with my sponsor out of the 12 and 12. I did a fourth step. I did a fifth step. I did some amends. And that's where I stopped. I prayed, but I didn't know anything about any meditating. I was willing to do 12-step work, but not a lot of people were asking me to be their sponsor. My sponsor did make me be the GSR for our home group, and that is what saved me for the next 15 years. She made me do service work, and I didn't want to do it ever. Not any position did I ever hold that I wanted to do. She just said, you got to do it. People that do service don't get drunk. And I still had enough willingness to do that. So I stayed sober for a long time. On the first part of step one, I didn't drink. I managed the hell out of my life. And part of step 12, I did some service work. I didn't practice many principles. And that worked really well for me for a while. I got a good relationship. I bought a house. I got a really good job. I got insurance. Got a car. Life was good. And I thought sobriety was wonderful. And I went to some meetings, and I went to my home group, and eventually I really got into working the material things were nice. I was liking having stuff. And so I started working a second job and wasn't able to go to meetings because I'm working all the time. But work's important, you know. I didn't come here just to go to AA meetings, you know. I got to have a life. And in order to have a life, I got to have stuff. And this is the way I thought. And so I still tried to get to my home group meeting as often as I could. And I made meetings here and there whenever I could. But something happened. Life was going along at a pretty good clip. And I was getting a lot of stuff. And I wasn't sponsoring anybody. I did service work occasionally. I would do my 2 years and then rest. And then do 2 years and rest. And then say, no, it's been too soon. I shouldn't do that again. And so I did that. And in the year 2000, everything, the big book describes it. There's a place in the big book where they talk about the morass of self-pity. And everything, it feels like there's no, everything is sandy, like quicksand. And so in the year 2000, that happened. My life got real quicksandy. Nothing felt secure or safe. I lost my job. I lost the house. I lost the relationship. But it wasn't just the losing things, although I didn't like that. And I thought, this isn't the way sobriety is supposed to be, because I didn't know what sobriety was about. I didn't really have a clue. But I was in a real precarious place. I was full of self-pity, full of fear, and I didn't know what to do. And all of a sudden, I'm running around like a crazy person. And I started going back to meetings. I don't know why, except it's all I knew. I'm grateful. So I started going back to meetings, and it would be nice to say, because I wanted to get closer to God and help people and, you know, to be of service. No, I was looking for a man. I thought that would take care of things. You know, I've been in a relationship forever, it seems like. And, you know, I need another relationship, and then things will get back like they were. So I'm chasing this guy. Poor guy. And I happened to go to his home group because that's where he was. And it was a big book part of the meeting. They had a discussion meeting downstairs and a big book topic meeting upstairs. So because he was doing the meeting upstairs, that's where I was. And the first night we went, they were in the doctor's opinion. And so I come there chasing this guy, and they're in the doctor's opinion, and something happened. I've read the big book so many times. I've always gone to big book studies. I know what, I don't really like the first 164 pages, but I've read them. So they're talking about stuff, and all of a sudden, again, something happened, and I started hearing things differently. Or maybe I just started hearing things for the first time. But they were talking about the phenomenon of craving, and they were talking about things that I had not really thought about in that way. I know today that I was, through God's grace, being exposed to the thing that was going to change my whole life and wake me up. And so I was beginning to have an awakening through no fault of my own. This is God's grace. And so I continued to go to that meeting, and I got to talking to this guy, and he's really sober. And he was laughing at me all the time because I'm sober. I've got more time year-wise than he does. So he's telling me all this stuff about sobriety and saying I don't have it. And I'm like, well, who the hell are you? I've been sober, you know, 15 years. I know what sobriety is. But he's talking about stuff that is interesting to me. It's in a different way. So I'm listening to him, and I'm going to this big book study, and there was a woman there. And she had, at the time, red hair, bright red hair, and she was really attractive. The thing she was saying was attractive. Her manner was attractive. Her joy was very attractive to me because I wasn't very joyful. I still am a lot of self-pity and fear. And so this guy said, you need a different sponsor. The sponsor I had who has helped me so much, given me so much, she had been having some health problems. And she was homebound and unable to get to meetings. And suffering from a lot of physical problems. But what was happening was, I was trying to help her. I really called myself trying to help her, but I was getting so much resentment because I would call up with a problem and she'd talk about hers. And I was really mad. What about me? You know? And I'm not sober, so I don't know how messed up that is. I don't even know what I'm doing. I think I'm trying to help her. So I would go over there and get her groceries and be so mad. She's not grateful. I go and do all this stuff. You'd think she'd show a little gratitude. And he's laughing at me. He said, you need to look at that. And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm over there helping her all the time. And I'm just, I don't know how to be of service to anybody. I don't have that experience. But I got a head full of stuff I think I know. So he said, you should ask this woman to be your sponsor, this other woman. And I said, okay. So I went to her. He said, you need to do the steps out of the big book. Okay, fine. So I asked her, I said, will you, I told myself I'm asking her to be my sponsor. But what I said was, will you work the steps out of the big book with me? And she, I'll never forget this. She said, I would be honored to do the steps with you. Now, when somebody asks me to sponsor, I'm like, oh, shit. Another burden for me. And here's this woman saying, I would be honored. Oh, God, that made me feel so good. That was the beginning of me thinking, well, how can I make them feel good like she made me feel good? Don't laugh at me. He's still laughing at me. So she said yes. And in my mind, I heard her say, yes, I'll be your sponsor. That's not what she said. So I'm going around telling all these people, this is my new sponsor. So she came up to me and me one night. She said, are you telling people I'm your sponsor? And I said, well, yeah, you are. No, I'm not. You asked me to work the steps out of the big book. You got a sponsor, don't you? And I said, yeah, but I don't want to do what she's doing. And she said, I'll work the steps with you, but until you talk to your sponsor, you've got one. And you'd think I would have known that, but no. And I'm going around talking about my old sponsor, terrible, and, you know, talking about my wonderful new sponsor, and I'm really just drunk with the whole thing, alcoholic with the whole thing. So finally I was over at Dorothy's house one day, and she really pissed me off. And I went in the bathroom and I said a prayer. I said, God, I got to tell her the truth, because I've been lying to her forever, lying about everything. And I went in there and I said, Dorothy, I have to tell you something. And she looked at me and she said, I'm not going to like it, am I? And I said, I don't think so, but I got to tell you. And I said, and I told her, I said, I found someone that I want to be my sponsor. I love you, and I am so grateful for what you did for me. And that was the truth. I said, but I want to do the steps out of the book with this woman. And she was mad. She was mad at me. She said, I'm mad at you. She said, but you do whatever you have to do to stay sober. And I'm so grateful that she, you know, I wish she had not been mad at me. You know, ideally I wanted her to say, oh, go do whatever you need to do, honey. But she wasn't. She was honest with me. And so I did a really sober thing, and I didn't even know I was doing it. I kept calling her. I kept in touch with her. I would go over there. It was so uncomfortable for me. And I did it anyway. I think that's great. And she was very cold to me at first. But I just kept picking up the phone. I just kept going over there. I love this woman. She helped me. I didn't want to throw her away. Eventually she warmed up. And we were able to be okay. Really, really grateful for that. And I worked the steps out of the big book with this new sponsor. And it was a different world. I started having an experience that I had never dreamed of. I would like to say it was like just bells and whistles and wonderful. It was frightening and it was hard. It was a lot different from the airy-fairy stuff I want to do. I don't want to do things that make me uncomfortable. I don't want to tell people the truth if they're going to, you know, be mad at me. I don't want to say yes to stuff I'm afraid to do. And that's what I had to do. And I didn't think I could do it. I remember somebody, I was sponsoring a lot of people. I was having this amazing experience that God was giving me. And a lot of women were asking me to sponsor them. And the old me, part of me was saying, oh, I'm hot shit. But part of me was like, oh, this is too much. When am I going to have time for me? I can't do all this. Me, me, me. And so this one girl came up to me and I said, oh, I don't know. Let me talk to my sponsor. So I called my sponsor up and told her that somebody had asked me to sponsor them, but I was afraid that I was a little overextended and that I really didn't think I could do them justice. And she said, just say yes. She said, God will take care of how extended you get. If somebody's asking you to help them, that means God wants you to help them. And if you can't help them, he'll get rid of them for you, or he'll get rid of you, or he'll take care of it. He said, but if they're asking, you're saying yes. And I'm like, this ain't going to work. But I said yes. And that was the beginning of a new way of life for me. I was asked to chair a big event down in Norfolk, the Saturday on the James. It's a big service event. And you have to get speakers and workshop chairs. And it's just like an organization. It's an event. But I was scared to death. They asked me to be the chair. And I'm like, no, I don't think so. I'm not, I don't have any experience. And I don't know what to do. And Bob Hickey and Glenn, he doesn't care if I say his last name. And Glenn came up to me and they asked me. And I said, no, I can't. I'll be co-chair. No, we really need a chair. And Bob knows me real well. I serve him liquor, I believe, at the bar. But he knows me pretty well. So he came up to me and he said, look, Kay. He said, you're a lightning rod. I like the sound of that. A lightning rod. That's something that attracts people. And I'm like, lightning rod? He said, yeah, you'll be great for this. So my ego took over and I'm like, well, okay then. If I'm going to be a lightning rod. It was, I would have said no to that if Bob hadn't tricked me into it. So I'm really grateful he did because it was a huge event in my life. Again, I don't know how to do this stuff. I'm afraid. It got done through everybody's help. Everybody's helpful in the rooms. I know that. And, you know, it got done. And the day of the event, I was freaking out. And, oh, this has not got done. And I'm going to get, and they're going to think this. And, you know, alcoholic thinking. And I'm going over to the TCC campus in Suffolk. And I'm freaking out. And the car in front of me had a license plate that said, God helps. And I looked at that and I said, okay, I forgot. God's going to do this. I just got to show up. And that has been the story of my sobriety until then. I was DCM for our district. I didn't want to be. I was tricked. And people are always tricking me. I must be pretty easy mark. But I told somebody, they said, you should stand for DCM. And I said, nah, if God wants me to do it, he'll get me up there. So I'm GSR and I'm at the election meeting and my name comes up. And I'm like, no, I voted for the other person. I really did want it. But I got to be DCM again. Such an amazing experience that I would have said, no, I can't do this. Such an amazing experience. I got to meet all these people. I got to know people at the Virginia Area Committee on a different level. I got to know people in my district on a different level. I'm learning about Alcoholics Anonymous and what makes it tick and how easy it is to do this because God does all the work. I just got to show up. How hard is that? I just have to show up. And look what happens when you just show up. I get to stay sober. I get to be happy. I get to help others. He shows me how to do that because I'm not very good at it. And all I do is show up. And I'm really grateful because left to my own devices, I don't show up for anything. Alcohol took me away. I never showed up for anything. I didn't have to. I had alcohol. I didn't have to show up for anything, and I didn't have to feel bad about it. Alcohol took care of that, too. So today, I try not to do that. My life today is changing rapidly, even as we speak. There's a lot of stuff going on. I live with my 96-year-old mother, who always took me in, who cleaned up my bruises and washed the blood off of me and took care of my daughter and never, ever, ever gave up on me. Never kicked me out of her life, though she should have. We lived together and have for the last 10 years almost. And up to recently, she's 96, but she's hell on wheels. She's a good 96. She's healthy. She has lived her whole life in service to others. It's what she loves. My father, I don't know, I guess I should say this in my mind. My father cheated on her when I was a baby. And he went off with this other woman, had two children by her. I have a sister that's 6 months younger than I am, half-sister. And my brother has a brother that's 6 months younger than he is. Times were hard, and he and this woman were off looking for work. They brought those babies home to my mother, and she took care of them. And loves them. I mean, she keeps in touch today. They're her kids. And that's the kind of woman she is. She gives freely. She lives to serve others. I didn't get those genes, but I get to be around her, and I get to try to acquire some of those genes. So I get to try to help her, and I haven't always done a very good job, but God is helping me with that, helping me a lot. I recently went to my oldest grandson's wedding in Memphis, Tennessee. And I thought it would be a good idea. My brother, it was going to be a big family event. My brother was coming from Oklahoma. We were going to take Mom with us, and he was going to take her home from there to spend some time with him and his wife. You know, they miss her. They want to be around her. And so, yeah, that'll be good. We'll take her up there. She did terrible on that trip. She had a little stroke, and she just started changing. And when we got there, he saw that she wasn't going to be able to go anywhere. And I was determined. She was coming home with me. She looks to me because we're together all the time. And I'm her security. And so I don't want to take that from her. Although I don't like it all the time, to be perfectly honest. But when I thought that, because I always just think people are going to live forever. You know, she's so healthy. But when I saw her in that weakened state, it really shook me. And I don't know if it's foxhole caring or what, but I've been a lot more caring with her. And I've wanted to be around her more. And God is helping me with that because it's not my natural inclination. She did much better once we got her home. She's pretty good today. She has to use a walker, but she's good. And I'm so grateful that God has given me this opportunity. And I have so much to pay back to her. And I get a chance to do it, you know. I don't want to blow it. So I'm very, very grateful that you asked me up here tonight. So grateful to see all you all and to have a place to go where I can just talk about me all the time. So thank you.